the What's the Crack podcast with Anthony Martin.
Listen in live weekly on Brighton's Radio Reverb.
See whatsthecrack.co.uk and radioreverb.com for showtimes.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. Thank you for downloading. I don't usually do this at the start of a podcast, but this is a bit of a special one. Paul McVeigh, the author of the book The Good Son, which won the City Reads for Brighton, he was in studio with me about a week ago, and before we went into the studio to record the interview, I gave him a very, very large cup of coffee, which certainly fueled him. We did have a chat for quite a while. Not all of it made the radio broadcast, the radio show that goes out on Radio Reverb every week. So this is the full interview. This is the full unedited interview. Let's cast our minds back to that wonderful coffee-fueled afternoon in Brighton. Now, in the studio with me at the moment, it's Paul McVeigh, author of The Good Son, the novel which has been chosen as Brighton's City Reads book for 2016. That festival runs from the 3rd of March to the 29th of May, with a number of fantastic events planned for it. Paul, hello and welcome.
Hello, how are you doing? Very happy to be here.
Good. Congratulations on the book.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, I'm pretty excited.
Yeah, it's been shortlisted for quite a few things. Yeah, The Guardian's Not the Booker Prize. It's been longlisted for the Waverton Good Read Award as well.
Yeah.
Elle Magazine, Best Books of 2015. Irish Independent, Top Reads of 2015. It's not bad for a first novel, is it?
Yeah, not bad at all. I'm pretty much delighted, you know. I'd worked on it for a really long time, and it took a while to get it out there in the world. So the fact that after taking such a long time and people saying, oh, you know, set in Northern Ireland, nobody's interested in the Troubles and everybody wants to move on, and oh, you've written it in a sort of Northern Irish dialect, no one will be able to read it and they won't be interested. So it's really great to prove them all wrong. that feels particularly good, you know.
Yeah, and it's a really good book. I just finished it there the other day, and I think the first kind of comparison or first kind of thing that came to my head when I finished it was, it's very like To Kill a Mockingbird. It kind of hits the same beats, I think, in a lot of ways, which is quite good. I'm not sure if that was what you're aiming for.
Well, I tell you, what I did was, the first draft of the book was very much sort of just throwing out lots of experiences and memories and other people's experiences and sort of creating this story over a summer holiday. But I went back and wrote the book, rewrote it a few years later, and I had this idea that I wanted not to just add another book to the list of books about the Troubles, you know. I decided that what I wanted to do was write a book that sort of contained everything I'd learned about the way people are, you know, and humanity and how people treat each other and what it really is all about. And life is about love and family and protection and loyalty and faith. And I wanted to look at the issues that were going on during the Troubles from that prism. And also sort of looking at what was going on in other places in the world and thinking, you know, well, actually, if this was, you know, another place like Syria, or you could pick any place where the society has broken down, and this child could be taken from Ardoyne in Belfast and placed in that dynamic, and observe through those innocent eyes, you know, the way society has broken down and the way people are behaving. That and I think with To Kill a Mockingbird, for example, you know, there is that feeling this kid is observing, you know, the civil rights movement and her father and how he's standing against it, and there's just this sense where through those innocent eyes the barbarity, you know, of the way adults are behaving just becomes magnified. And from that innocence, you kind of think, you join in with that point of view, don't you? And you think, what are these people doing to each other? I mean, this is crazy. Why is it because of the color of your skin or because you're born in that side of the street? Do you not have the right to vote when these people do? You know, and people forget 1968 when I was, you know, born in Northern Ireland that, you know, you weren't guaranteed a vote if you were a Catholic.
Mm.
And that's extraordinary. I mean, that's in the UK. I mean, I'm not talking like in the, you know, people think about the Troubles, they think like it's like the Falklands or something.
Yeah.
Or it's like something from, you know, the Boer War. It's like hundreds of years ago. It's kind of in our lifetime and an hour away, you know, that these things were happening. It's quite an extraordinary thing to think, really.
The main character, Mickey Donnelly, beautifully written character, absolutely amazing character. He's innocent, he's naive, he's loving, he's lost, and he's really struggling with his own identity with the background of the Troubles.
Mm.
How did you develop him? How did you come up with the idea of Mickey Donnelly?
Well, thanks very much, first of all. But yeah, I mean, I when I first tried to write prose, I looked on the internet and it said, you know, start with things that you know, you know. So I was like, okay, you know. Before that, I'd been writing plays and comedy and always in a group dynamic. So, you know, you were, and usually to commission. So I knew what I was doing and what I was setting out to do. So writing something that was just for me and writing it by myself, I just didn't know what to do. And also prose for the first time. So I wasn't writing dialogue. So I had to have like an author's voice. Like, what was I trying to say about the world? Or, and it was like, oh, right, but you know, so I thought about my past and I thought about this story where I'd gone to visit my aunt. And so I started writing the story. I had an invitation to be part of an anthology with 5,000 word limit. And I found that, you know, this kid had written 5,000 words and he hadn't got to the bottom of the lane to get to his answers yet. And I thought, holy moly, what am I going to do here? So, that story did really well. And I thought, okay, well, you know, why don't I try and see if I can make this into a longer thing? And so, you know, I started off definitely from a memory that I'd had. And I definitely started off writing about an arena that I knew. I knew about the Troubles. I knew about my childhood. I knew it was an extraordinary time and very rich, full of details that I hadn't seen written before.
Mm.
I'd seen stories of the Troubles written, and I'd seen the kind of, you know, the IRA man who's on the run, and the, you know, and the sort of MI5 agent who's after him, and the undercover cop, and the, I'd seen the, you know, Love Across the Barricade story a million times, and I'd seen, you know, there was, you know, there was these stories I'd seen, and what I wanted to do was say, you know, here's a story about a little boy who loves his mum, and he'll do anything to save her and protect her from herself, and protect her from what's going on in the streets around him, and his little sister as well. So he really just, it's a story about love and family, but it's set in a time where, you know, these, to be a child, you just lived in fear, you know, of what was going to happen outside all the time, you know.
And I suppose, you know, I suppose it sounds quite grim when you describe it like that, but there is a lot of comedy running through the book as well. A lot of dark comedy, isn't there?
Yeah. And I mean, I love comedy, you know, so I wrote comedy for 8 years. So, I mean, you know, I really, again, when I was writing, I was thinking, you know, try to play to your strengths, you know, because I think quite often, you start off, you know, writing and you're thinking you're trying to be other people, or you're trying to, you know, match other people's skills and talents and see if you can kind of compete with them.
Mm.
And then, you know, gradually you realize, or certainly for me anyway, I was like, if I'm going to do this, you know, I might as well feel on my own terms rather than trying to be somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm going to take all my strengths, even if they're not supposed to be technically, you know, the strengths of a novel. People wouldn't really say dialogue, for example, is a big component of a novel. They wouldn't think like that.
Yeah.
I've got loads of dialogue in there because I used to write plays and comedies, and I'm used to delivering character and jokes through how people speak, and you know, and so I really had fun, you know, because Northern Irish people as well were very funny, and you had to be funny because life was bloody grim, you know. So, you know, and so comedy was like a weapon, you know, to protect yourself. Comedy was, it was also a shield, you know, because other people would kind of, you know, well, society was very dark and things were coming. So you just kind of, you know, it bounced off you if you could laugh about it and other people's jokes and jibes, you know. I mean, definitely humor is, floats the story. You know, it's on every page practically, even in the most extraordinarily tense scenes, you know, someone comes out with something funny, or he's in his head going off on some sort of little journey, you know, where to combat the, you know, this kind of dark situation, you know.
I suppose that between the mother and the son as well, there's a lot of comedy, isn't there? The kid always trying to make his mother laugh and trying to lighten the mood.
And I think she's hysterical. I mean, I think his mum is hysterical, you know, like, and I think it was quite a hard thing to do because there's a, you know, some people have said to me, oh my God, I was really frightened of the mum. The mum is scary, you know, like she's always hitting him and she's always, and I was trying to explain this kind of sort of pre, you know, let's everyone be really careful around children life that we all lead now.
Yeah.
You know, when you were a kid and your teacher used to hit you slap across the head, you know, when you were, when I was a kid, sorry, you know, and when we were young, you know, your mum hit you kicking, you know, throw you out of the house, you know, and, and a lot of time you laughed.
Yeah,
it wasn't hurt. It wasn't hurt. It didn't hurt you. You know, my mom. You know, your mom would just knock it out and, you know, and come on, Eusens, and grab you by the scruff of the neck and throw you in the street. You know, and we just thought it was hysterical. You know, and I think there's a kind of fear around all that stuff now. And I guess I wanted to show a little bit of that kind of. So it's a little bit. It can make you feel edgy at times, but you know, I wanted to say, you know, well, we were being part of it was toughening you up.
Yeah.
You know, for the streets. You know, because the streets were pretty tough. And, you know, so doing it in a kind of rough and tumble, rough, lovey way was a way of, you know, getting you ready for the stuff that come with it didn't come with love, you know, outside, I guess. And,
And was that relationship, was that paramount to the story? Because I guess the title, The Good Son, so that relationship was obviously something that you kind of focused a lot on and you kind of thought a lot about. Was that the reason you named it The Good Son?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that for me, it was, you know, he defines himself through his mum. You know, he defines himself in terms of how his mum sees him.
Right.
You know, am I a good boy? Is my mum, you know, am I doing my best to protect her? And he thinks he can see things that she can't, you know.
Yeah.
And he knows better than her. He knows what's best for her because she does keep making very bad decisions. He doesn't understand the complexity of it, just like he doesn't understand the complexity of the political situation, which is why I don't go into it too much. But he just sees things and goes, but why would that be? Why would people treat people like that? Or why would that happen? He's like that with his mom. Like, why is my mom doing this? He doesn't understand the complexity of it. But what he thinks is, well, you know, she clearly can't deal with this herself, so she's going to need me to step in.
Yeah,
you know, and he's going to make, as you know, you've read it at the end, a pretty extraordinary decision on her behalf.
He does yeah. Indeed. And so you said the book kind of started off as a short story. How long ago was that then? How long ago did you write that?
A long time ago. So probably over 11, 12 years ago.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, I wrote a short story and then it did very well. And I went on a bit of a book tour with the anthology. And but of course, I just had that arrogance where I thought, oh, now I've written a short story. Now I can write a novel. Sure, for God's sake, you know, what's the difference? You know, wrong. You know, it's a completely different thing.
And it's such a big task.
Yeah. And I had a lot of lessons to learn. And I probably wrote a draft within about a year and then, you know, left it. And then I had one point about 3 years in where I was finished and my laptop got corrupted and I lost the whole thing.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah, these were before the days. I mean, I guess there were floppy disks you could save on or something, maybe about 12, you think about 10 years ago.
And how much time had you put into it at that
stage? Oh, about 3 years.
Oh, my
God. I mean, it takes a long time, especially your first one takes a long time because you don't know what you're doing and you keep making huge mistakes. And so I really had to start again from scratch. But because I was so disheartened, I didn't do anything for about 2 years. I was teaching playwriting and comedy sketch writing for Hampstead Theatre in London and Tricycle Theatre in Kilburn, and I just gave up writing for a while. And then when I started again, it was very slow. And then I came up with another draft and got with an agent who really loved it. And then nothing happened. That really knocked my confidence. I left it again for about another 3 years. So even though, you know, I say all those years, I wasn't working on it all the time.
Yeah. And was the second draft then, after the computer broke down, was that a completely different? Was it very similar?
No, it was. Well, I tried as much as possible to recreate what I'd written. Mm. I wasn't thinking, I didn't know at that stage what I was later to learn about writing novels. I learned a lot later on. And then I also changed a lot. Mm. So that when I sort of got back to rewriting, my guess was about 3 or 4 years ago, I was a different person and I had different things I wanted to say and I'd learned a lot more about life and, you know, looking back on things, I just sort of thought, well, rather than write this book that tried to reveal I guess, you know, people say sometimes about, you know, shining a light into dark areas. You know, I definitely felt that the first time around, that I wanted to say, do you guys have any idea what it was like? I mean, any idea. I mean, on a daily basis, trying to get to school, trying to, you know, have you any idea? And I was quite angry, I think, I realize. And I want, and I was angry, and I wanted people to know I was angry, and I wanted them to read it and feel bad. I wanted people to go like, oh my God, this is terrible. Where were we? Why did we not get involved? Why did we not help these kids and these people? Blah, blah, blah. Well, when I rewrote it, I didn't feel that at all. And I felt like, I think when you get older as well, you know, you think you want people to be kind to your mistakes. You know, you don't want to be remembered for the things, you know, that you did really badly or were remiss in or ignorant of. You know, you want to be remembered for the things you tried to do and your good intentions and the good things. And I guess when I wanted to sort of take an attitude of a kindness towards the characters and towards the place, and I wanted to say, you know, and so instead of getting cross with like humanity, I was trying to say, you know, look at how amazing humanity is, because here's these extraordinary difficult times, the pressure that people are under, and what they have to witness and endure, and yet they laughed and loved, and I wanted to focus on those things, to say, aren't human beings amazing? And those are the things that keep humanity alive.
Earlier today, I asked you to, or before we came in, I asked you to come up with two songs that kind of resonate with the book. Your first song, what have you chosen for your first song?
When you asked me, I was thinking about it now, and I've chosen Teenage Kicks, and partly because, you know, you'd said to me about Irish songs, and I remember when I was growing up, you know, I had two older brothers, so you know, a lot of it was about me, you know, about learning music from them, you know, and my older sisters too, you know, and so, you know, because, you know, it's, you know, the days where they went and saved their money up for an LP, you know, when they came back, and it was played non-stop for the next few weeks, and they'd fight over who could have the, you know, the record player song. And I remember that, you know, I remember this song coming out, and I remember the sense of pride as well, because this was a Northern Irish band, and it was doing well in the UK, and there's still that thing in Northern Ireland, I think, you know, when someone from Northern Ireland does well outside of Northern Ireland, everybody's just like so pride, you know, and it's a lovely thing. So I think this was a real sense of people of the time. It captured that period of time and that feeling. I remember when I was young, of just kind of my brothers kind of being, you know, really into this kind of music. It reminds me of that.
Cool, excellent. So let's play it right now. This is Teenage Kicks from the Undertones. You're listening to What's the Crack here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM and on DAB. That was The Undertones with Teenage Kicks. And that song was picked by Paul McVeigh, who is in the studio with me at the moment. He's an author of a book called The Good Son, which has been chosen as City Reads Book 2016. Now, Paul, you're actually going to read an extract from that book right now, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm just going to read you like a page and a half, right from the beginning, just to sort of launch it straight in there. Okay, so this is chapter one. You ready?
Very good, let's go. Okay.
I was born the day the troubles started. Wasn't I, Ma, says me. It was you that started them, son, says she, and we all laugh, except our Paddy. Now, I put that down to his pimples and his general ugliness. It must be hard to be happy when you've a face like that. I almost feel sorry for him. I spy a dirty big love bite on his neck, and I store this ammunition to defend myself against future attacks. Steamy, flowery-smelling disinfectant fills my nose and joins the sweet-tasting frosties in my mouth as Ma passes with the tin bucket and yard brush. Ma only cleans the yard when something's up, and that would be da as usual. Do you want a hand, Mammy? Says me. No, son, says she, disappearing out the back. She didn't even look at me. I'm worried about her after last night.
Do you want a hand?
Our Paddy says in a girl's voice. Your wee lick. I'm tell my mummy and you, I say.
I'm tell my mummy and you,
our Paddy mimics me. I look at wee Maggie and give her the we just hate him, don't we, look. She gives me the yes we do, he's a big fat pig look back. I was taught how to give looks by a monk on Cave Hill. I trained like a Jedi Knight, but my lightsaber was my actual face. I became Luke Skywalker. My mission, to defend all weaklings and younger ones and families against the evil that is older brothers. Wee Maggie is now my disciple. To test her telepathy training, I send, don't worry about him, because he's going to be knocked down by a car, then a lorry will run over his head, making his eyes pop out. Wee Maggie smiles. She got it. I think we're actually twins, born years apart in some CIA super genetic test tube type experiment. Paddy gets up, leaving his dirty bowl on the table like he's King Farouk. Don't leave that for mummy, I say. Mummy's boy, says he. Shut up, you, I say. At least I don't have a dirty, big love bite.
That's beautiful. Really good. You've done an audiobook as well, haven't you? You've recorded that.
Yeah. I mean, that was interesting, actually. I love reading, right? I do, you know, events where I come and read, and I love getting into character and stuff, you know. And so when they asked me to do the audiobook, I was absolutely delighted to go. I thought, yeah. But I had to audition.
Did you? Really?
Yeah. And I actually said to a few people, you know, authors I know that are sort of, you know, further on in their career than me, you know, and I, you know, they were like, yeah, I wasn't allowed to do mine. They were saying to me, you know,
really?
Oh, you know, because they want, obviously, you know, a good performer to read it. And sometimes authors just aren't that, you know, they're,
okay.
You know, so, so I had to on an audition. I was absolutely affronted, and then I did it, and they said, "Oh, you're going to." But it wasn't as much fun as I thought it was going to be, you know, because when I'm doing it, you know, in at a launch or an event, you know, my hands are all over the place. I'm getting into camp, putting on little voices, and I'm moving around,
you
and
acted
little
out.
Faces, and
everything. Yeah.
I absolutely love it. But of course, none of that matters when you're sitting in this tiny wee room and a wee booth, you know, all on your own for hours and hours and hours at a time, you know. And after about the second or third chapter, I was really bored. I was like, oh, God. And then, you know, there's, you know, different characters and stuff. And you think, oh, God, yeah, I never thought about, like, you know, four or five different people speaking. And yeah, just the whole thing of not being able to move around, you know, having to sit still and then make it smaller so that, you know, and slower.
Yeah.
And so suddenly I was like, oh, God.
What have I got myself into?
Definitely an interesting experience, yeah.
So you're like, what did I get myself into?
Yeah.
And how many hours did it take, or how many days did it take to record?
I think it maybe took like three days, I think.
3 days.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's out now, so you can get that. I think it's on Audible and all that kind of thing. It was great, you know, also, you know, just that they wanted to make one, you know. So, I hope. I don't know if anyone who's heard it. There's probably people out there who have bought it, you know, but I just haven't met any of them yet. And I'd love to know what they think, you know, just to see whether they thought it was any good.
Well, you can let us know if you want to tweet what's the crack or I can forward that on to you. Yeah, that'd be good. Now your own background. You grew up in Northern Ireland. Whereabouts did you grow up?
I grew up in Belfast. I was born in 1968, so I'm old. What is this? 2000? Jesus Christ, I'm nearly 50. No, I'm 47, I think. Or 40. Yeah, 40, 48 this year. Holy crap.
I think that there comes a point where you just don't keep track of your age.
No, I know. It was quite funny because last year I had to work out how old I was, and it was my birthday, and I realized I was 47. But I'd been telling people for 2 years I was 47. So it's quite funny. I was making people say, they said, you're always 47. Yeah, but actually that's not because I'm lying. It was because of the other 2 years I didn't get 45 and 46. I feel like I've cheated myself out of two younger years.
You've missed two birthdays. Yeah, you've missed two birthdays.
Yeah, well, I had them. I just kept calling myself 47 every time. So I've just had three 47 birthdays. That's all. That's like...
So you grew up in Belfast. So I suppose a lot of the material in the book, then, you're obviously very familiar with, and you lived through yourself. When did you leave Belfast? When did that time come?
Well, I left. I guess the first time
When I went to university, you know, when I was, I guess, 18, 19, I went to the University of Ulster at Coleraine and lived up in Port Stewart on the coast of a wee seaside town where lots full of university students, you know, and, you know, walking around during the day in their pajamas, which was these days it'll be their onesies, you know, where, you know, you just had that crazy sort of student thing, you know, but then you had all the kind of locals as well, so it was just this really weird mixture, you know.
Yeah,
you'd have on a Sunday night there was the prom sort of drive-by where all the local kids would come from everywhere and they would drive, and they would just drive really slowly, like, you know, with the music playing out along the prom, like you know, it was all really cool and everything, you know. And they just went round the back then and came back and up and did it again, and they just did that all day. That was like a Sunday. And but then you just have all these crazy students all running around, you know, thinking they were really funny and dressed stupidly. And
was that quite different to Belfast then? Was it a different kind of atmosphere?
Very different. Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, the troubles existed outside of Belfast, but it was mostly contained there, Belfast, in the big cities, you know. And a little town like that on the coast didn't really, you know, it didn't have a huge impact, certainly not when I was there anyway.
Yeah.
And so there was a very different atmosphere. Also, you know, I was at university, so, you know, I'd escaped my family, you know, and I was going completely bananas and growing long hair and beards and talking nonsense and stuff like that, and, you know. It was great, you know, so it was really formative.
Yeah, so that was kind of like coming of age for yourself. When you were growing up in Belfast, were you conscious of, we'll say, the troubles, what it meant to people in Ireland and outside of Ireland? Was that something that you kind of were conscious of growing up?
Well, of course, I lived in the troubles, so you couldn't get away from it. I mean, you were forced to have a side and forced to have an opinion, you know, just by where you were born, and you didn't really have a choice. When I started to travel and in my late teens, particularly in my early 20s and late 20s, you know, you got to see what other people thought, and, you know, around the world, and that really, that was very interesting. I mean, my attitude towards Southern Ireland, for example, changed quite a lot, and continues to change, actually. Because I had always, being brought up as a nationalist in Northern Ireland, because of, you know, where I was born on my street. Like, I was saying to someone yesterday, it's like, actually, you know, if I was born like 500 meters from where I lived across the other side of the barricade, I would have been a British Protestant.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have a choice. That's what I would have been, you know. And yet I was born. So really, nationality in that sense was an accident of birth. You know, I could have been either, and so when I went away, we did have the sense where, you know, Southern Ireland were, you know, like, I think there's an analogy I use, you know, like it's sort of like the mother with the open arms, you know, waiting for you to get away from this kind of, you know, cold, cruel father that's kind of keeping you away from them, you know. And there was this kind of sense of that. And then, you know, you grow up and you went and you visited, and actually you realise that, first of all, the interim period was definitely when I went away. I remember being in bars and things abroad and meeting people from Southern Ireland thinking, oh, you know, everyone go, oh, you're Irish, you know, and you'd have some locals sort of going, oh, IRA, bang, bang, you know, like this, you know, and sort of jumping up and down like this was fantastic or something.
Yeah.
And you would have this kind of sense where, for Northern Ireland, I would laugh, you know, because I just thought, you know, well, of course that's what they see, you know, whatever. But you had this sense from Southern Irish people, like they would look at you and say, you know, do you see what we have to deal with? Like, this is what we get when we go away. Like, this is your fault. Like, you know, we're getting this.
Did you get that sense?
Oh, definitely. Oh, absolutely. And repeatedly as well.
And was this only at a specific time or now even?
Well, I'm talking about that period of time when I first got out of Northern Ireland and how my opinions changed. And I was really, I remember being really shocked at the degree to which I felt, let's say, a sense of unwelcomeness, or I would say antagonism, I don't know. But there was definitely a sense where there was, like, you know, you see what we have to put up. We're lumped in and we're blamed for what you do. This is what happens to us when we're away. And I remember thinking, oh, God, how awful for you. Oh, that must be awful. I only had to live it. Yeah. Could you imagine? And imagine you having to deal with that when you're on your holidays. It must be terrible. Do you want to come and live in Ardyne for a couple of weeks and see just how horrible you think it is? So I think, you know, that was a real shift for me. I remember thinking, actually, no, this isn't quite as simple as it looks, because everything always, oh, you must be like this and you must have opinions that because you're from here or because you're on that side. And actually then I started to have a more complex, wider perspective, which is what travel gives you. You go out and you meet people and you think, actually, you know, the world is not just about Catholic, Protestant, English, British, Irish, or, you know, what and not what you think as a young person and what you're told to believe. Actually, the world is a very complex thing full of very complex emotions and allegiances, and things aren't always what they seem.
But that must have been quite a difficult kind of situation, because I suppose you're stuck then between the south of Ireland and the Protestant side or Unionist side. You're kind of stuck somewhere in the middle where you're versus them and versus them as well. Does that make sense?
Well, I think definitely. Did you feel that? For me, I mean, my opinions definitely then changed again. And they actually changed again recently as well, because I was asked to write this essay as a response to the 100th anniversary of 1916. And I actually find through the process of writing it that actually I had travelled a very long distance away from, you know, the when I had first become a man. And, you know, over the last sort of 25 years or something, I hadn't realised how much I'd changed in my opinions about of Ireland and things. And I guess my analogy sort of changed, and I started thinking that, you know, actually, you know, Southern Ireland is the mother that left for a better life. It's not the mother, you know, that I thought it was. You know, I mean, it made a decision to leave.
Yeah.
And leave Northern Ireland behind. That's a very different thing than feeling like your mother was there with her arms up and going, you know, your daddy took us away or something. Mm. So I sort of changed that, and I also had the thing, you know, that, you know, actually Britain, you know, wasn't this fiercely protective father who fought to keep you, but actually a father who was bringing you up out of obligation. So actually in Northern Ireland, you were this unwanted child who is used politically at times to make a point, but actually isn't really wanted by either.
At what age then did you move away from Northern Ireland? What age?
I think that I'm an old man now. But I think I moved to London around, I guess I was probably about 25, and I'm what, 47, so about 20 odd years ago. And I lived in London and loved it. Yeah. I mean, I completely fell in love with London. It was like the best city in the world for me, because, you know, I mean, you know, I went from sort of a really closed community, like a kind of almost open air prison, you know, with barricades at the top of the street and the bottom of the street, to this city where no one knew you, you know. So in a closed community, everybody knows your business. Everybody's, you know, you do something three streets away and your ma knows before you get home. You know, I mean, you know, the jungle drums that we've been right there, you know. Everyone watches you, knows you, you know. And so it was great for me, the anonymity, you know, and I just had this sense of freedom of, you know, being able to, you know, dress the way I wanted to and listen to kind of music, go to underground clubs, and, you know, just, I just did everything that London had to offer. You know, I barely slept, you know, I just did everything, you know, and absolutely fell in love with it. Yeah.
And was that when your passion for creative things, did that get nourished in London, or was that there before that?
Oh, it was definitely there before that, you know, because I'd studied theatre at university, and I'd set up a theatre company in Belfast just before I went away, and I worked on that for 2 years. I set up a theatre festival there as well. So, you know, I had already started on that journey. I went to London and I started writing comedy there, actually, and I did my creativity change, but it just took on a different face or something.
Yeah.
And that was great, because I was going to comedy clubs, I was meeting great comedians, I was, you know, I was laughing for a living, as I kind of thought at the time, and, you know, and I had a pretty amazing time. It was brilliant. Absolutely loved it. I'll always have a wee place in my heart for London. You know, now, you know, I mean, I don't think I have the same feelings towards it. It's a wee bit like having an ex. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a
wee bit like that. It's a wee bit like, you know, it just started getting comfortable the last couple of years and just, you know, we just didn't excite each other the way we used to. And then, you know, eventually we broke up. It was a little bit messy.
Yeah.
You know, we needed a wee bit of time not seeing each other. Now we see each other now and again, but it's a bit uncomfortable. And, you know, you get little flashes of what you had, but it'd just never be the same.
So that kind of period of your life is gone now.
Definitely feels like that, you know. Never say never, but yeah, I think, yeah, I have no inclination to live in London now.
Now, you were talking about kind of writing comedy and writing in general. How would you describe your kind of your writing process? How do you get into the zone, I guess, or how do you get into the mood?
It's a funny one. I haven't been writing so much recently, and so it feels like a question you'd need to ask someone else, like the me that did that. Like,
yeah.
I don't know if you ever feel like that. Sometimes you think, did I used to do that? Oh yeah, I did. Yeah, well, yeah. Who was that guy? But I think definitely music's always been a very big inspiration for me. So quite often I found it's like a really quick way to get to that place. You know, that place where you're vulnerable or where music can unsettle you or excite you really quickly. You know, I used to have like favorite songs. You know, and I used to play them the moment I woke up. Just to set my day off, I'd go, boom, that's my tune. Like, you know, that's the tune that's going to get me through the day. And, you know, and sometimes I think for writing, it was, you know, I really love, I love songs that tell a story. I love songs that are like characterful. Mm-hmm. And I love songs that are, expose emotion in some way and have a vulnerability. And I think when I hear that, it's like I sort of, very quickly open up and feel like it's touching something. And when I write, I'm a very emotional writer. I like to kind of get to the heart of something, and I like to imbue my writing with that sort of emotionality. So music, definitely
helps. Yeah, that brings us kind of very nicely on to your second song choice, actually. Tell us what it is. Why?
It's Sinead O'Connor's Troy. I mean, I love Sinead O'Connor. I mean, she polarizes people. I personally think she's the voice of an angel. I mean, when she sings, it just transports me. And I love all of her music. And then there are certain songs that just make me weep, you know, and their truth and the way she, I think she's very brave in the way she exposes herself in her songs. But as I say, I'm aware of how polarizing she is. I mean, some people just can't abide her. I am not one of those people.
But she's great at what she does. She really is. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, and as a songwriter as well. I mean, yeah. So this song I remember because it was a story, and you know, I just hadn't heard something like that. And her anger as well. There's like the emotional register, because quite often people write emotional songs, but they don't sing emotionally.
Yeah.
So I think what she did in the song at the time for me was a revelation. In terms of storytelling, revealing of vulnerability, revealing of anger, and a sense of musically beautiful. I think it really, really works.
Okay, let's play that right now. This is Sinead O'Connor with Troy.
I remember it. Ducking in a rainstorm, sitting in the long grass in summer.
That is Troy from Sinead O'Connor. You're listening to What's the Crack here on Radio Reverb. At the moment in studio, we are speaking to author Paul McVeigh. He wrote the book The Good Son, which has been chosen as Brighton's City Reads book for this year. Now, Paul, you're actually going to read an extract from that book right now, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm going to read a little bit from chapter 3. Gives you a wee flavour of what it was like to be a kid and growing up in Ardoyne. And also just a little kind of look at his personality and his family. Okay. I'm not allowed in the house because it'll annoy Da, which is really, really not fair because there's so much brilliant TV on. Ma said she doesn't know why I'd want to be sitting in on a day like this anyway. She said every child in the whole world would want to be out playing. I wish she'd make up her mind, because most of the time she tells me not to play with the ones in our street. everything changes in the summer. Dad's off the drink and the fags again, which makes him sick. He's really going to try this time, I said. That'll be about the 1,000th time. But you never know. He did get me my dog Killer. Ma took wee Maggie to work, with her saying that I was too wee to mind her, but big and ugly enough to look after myself. But she won't let me take Killer out yet. I nearly did anyway. I don't know what difference it makes if I take him out when Ma's home or not. I don't understand her. Like Weetabix, brown sauce, how TV beams across the sky, the Bermuda Triangle, and the bizarrest of all, the offside rule in football. I have very clear instructions. Don't go to the top of the street, because there's always riots. Don't go to the bottom of the street, because there's no man's land, and there's always riots. Don't go near the Bray or the Bone Hills, because that leads to the proddy Old Park, where they throw stones across the road from their side. Don't go into the old houses, because a wee boy fell through the stairs in one and broke his two legs. I think his neck, too. Ma could be exaggerating. Oh, and don't go to the Eggy Field, because there's glue sniffers. Ma should have just tied me to a gate or locked me in a cupboard.
That's really good. That sums up Mickey very much, yeah, so, doesn't it? It really does. So the book, as we mentioned, is being chosen as a City Reads 2016 choice. When did you find that out?
It was around, I think it was around kind of Christmas, New Year. I was at home in Belfast, actually, visiting my family. And I was actually visiting my mum, and I remember getting the phone call, and I seriously, honestly did a little jig. I mean, you know, people say things like that, you know, oh, you do a little jig. And I think, that'd be so racist. Like, or, you know, we don't do things like that. We just, because we're Irish, you know. But I literally did, while on the phone. You know, so I think, yeah, I was trying to cover my tracks, like, you know, but I mean, over the moon. I mean, I came here, you know, 4 years ago or so, and volunteered for City Reads when I moved here, and I really got to know Brighton by sort of, you know, being part of the events. And for example, there was one event that was a walk around Brighton, and I went, and I was sort of the guy who took the tickets, and I went around the walk and listened to it, and I wanted to, you know, surround myself with books, because I'd sort of spent a little bit of time not writing, and so it got me back into books, it got me into a new city, I met people, and then I volunteered the next year. So it's just amazing that this huge project that I've been a part of for these years, now it's my book that people are volunteering to help, you know. It's like, you know, it's just such a great story, and just feels like a perfect gift, you know. If there was a, you know, perfection in life, that kind of, you know, a symmetry of how, you know, one thing can lead to another, and it's amazing, great feeling.
Yeah, so I suppose especially for first time novel as well, you must feel, yeah, I wouldn't say relieved, but kind of justified in the amount of work you put into it. It must be a great kind of payoff.
Yeah, I definitely think that. You know, I think, you know, you work really hard for a long time on a book, and especially when you know it was very hard to get it published, and there was a lot of, you know, resistance to that. And I think that, you know, there's not a lot of money in publishing, you know, and so you know, it's really difficult for a debut novice to get any attention at all. I mean, even getting reviewed is really tough for a debut novelist. I mean, unless you're one of the big five publishing houses, and even then you're not guaranteed a review. So I mean, the book, I mean, it's out nearly a year, it's done so well. I mean, here I am nearly a year later, and it's been chosen for City Reads, and it's coming out in France in about 2 weeks, and then it'll be out in Germany, I think, in August. And you know, I mean, so that is, you know, I can't believe it's the gift that keeps on giving, you know. It's just, yeah, it's you know, so yes, it's definitely feels like there's a just reward that's come out of all that work, you know.
And then we mentioned the events. There is an event coming up this Thursday, if you're listening to the Monday or Tuesday show. It's on St. Patrick's Day, and it's a whiskey tasting
event. And, you know, it's sold out already.
Yeah, I see that.
And there was an event last night. We had a movie that I got to choose, and it sold out. And so, you know, all the events are selling out super quick, you know, so... you know, yeah, so the whiskey tasting, St. Patrick's Night, you know, I'm going to be there, and we get to taste some whiskey. We've got some music, some traditional music going on, and, you know, there are rumours flying around that there will be little surprises.
Oh. Do you know who the surprises are? What
I mean, there's talk of, you know, of maybe a few songs, and I might teach some a little song, a funny song that I know from the olden days.
Okay.
And it might be a little. There might be a little jigger dance going on there. I can feel like I could pull a few people up. And maybe give them call out a wee dance or something like that.
I have heard the rumor that you are a prized Irish dancer.
Get
is that right?
Out of here. Oh, all right then. Yes, I know. But I'm not sure that I'll be given any kind of display or anything like that. But I was thinking more like, you know, pulling the chairs back and doing the Waves of Tory or something like
right,
that.
Right,
okay. Know? And it's all kind of, you know, having a bit of a giggle. But you never know. Depending how good the whiskey is, I might end up doing a tap or who knows. No, I will not. I don't even know why I'm saying that. I will not do that. But, you know, there'll be talk anyway.
If you see people Irish dancing down the street on St. Patrick's evening, Paul McVeigh will be at the head of the queue.
I'll maybe dig out a kill. I don't know.
And what other events that are planned for around the festival?
I know that. I mean, the big one for me is the City Reads Festival finishing May 29th. The amazing thing is that this year the festival is the City Reads is going to be joined up with Brighton Festival as part of the 50th year anniversary celebrations, because actually City Reads started off as part of the festival, so then it went off on its own because it got so big. So it's a really lovely, again, that kind of feeling of symmetry, of how something goes back to where it started, but be part of these big celebrations. So I get to have an event in the Brighton Dome, you know, which I'm really excited about. You know, I really hope people will come along. I'm going to do some reading. I'm going to be interviewed by a columnist and novelist, Laura Lockington. And she runs events, book events here all the time. She's amazing. And I'm really looking forward to that. I think some of my family are going to come over from Belfast and things. Oh, wow. So there'll be a bit of Ulian going on there. And so that's a really exciting thing. We've got, there's a book quiz that you can come along to. And I think they're going to have like a special round on my book. So that'll be quite fun. And I think there's a couple of book quizzes actually. And there's another film screening. So we had one last night that sold out. The next one is Cal, which was a film set in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, and I think Helen Mirren is in that.
Yes,
yeah, yeah.
And it's an amazing film with John Lynch as well, with a little introduction by Professor Graham Dawson. And, you know, and it's a film set in the Troubles, but it's also a love story, and it's a really beautiful film. So if you get the chance to come along and see that, there's still tickets for that. It's in April. And there's also a book swap, I think that's the day before the event at the Dome. Yeah, this is Saturday the 20th. And you can bring books along, and I think there's kind of like hot drinks, and you just sort of encouraged to come and swap your books. Nice way to kind of, you know, replenish those shelves without having to fork out all the money. Yeah, so, I mean, lots of events. I mean, I hope people come along, and I think the one I'm looking forward to as well, actually, is an event where local authors are going to come along and read from their favorite books with child narrators.
Okay.
I mean, it's called Amongst the Grown-Ups. And I think that's going to be a lot of fun. So Bethan Roberts is going to read that. And she, her book, My Policeman, was actually one of the City Reads choices. I think that was maybe 3 years ago that I did my volunteering on.
Oh.
So she's now going to come and read this. So that's going to be exciting. And lots of authors, I think there's maybe like 12 or 13 authors are going to come read just for 5 minutes each. So you'll see lots of different authors reading from some of your favorite books. There's lots of stuff going on. And I think there's book groups reading the book all around the city. And Waterstones have been amazing. They put posters in
the whole
window.
There's a whole thing, isn't there, in the window?
Yeah. I mean, like, that's like, wow. I've never, I mean, you know, I don't think I've had a front window yet. So
have you done the selfie thing? You haven't.
No.
Yeah.
I'm really cool, actually. They put it up when I was away, actually.
Okay.
But when we had the launch, and I came down and I saw it, and I was just like, my jaw just dropped.
Wow.
You know what I mean? I was standing outside it, like kind of smiling and like hoping that someone would notice. I was like, and when I went inside, there had a big poster just inside the door, and I was really gutted. There was no one in the shop, you know. So there was, and then I noticed two people at the counter.
So I went over and said, did you see the big poster over there? And they were like, yeah, and I went, that's me. And they went, God, she's so nice. Isn't that great? And I was going, yeah, thanks very much. That's all. I just wanted somebody to acknowledge that that's actually true. And
so
I'm seeing it.
It's still sinking in, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, like, you know, Brighton is really supporting it. The book, you know, Waterstones is supporting it. You know, people have been like messaging me with pictures of people reading it on the bus.
I've seen those, yeah.
Really make me laugh. I mean, I love it. You know, here's someone on the number 7. Here's someone on the 3. There's 2 people on my bus this morning. I was going, oh my God. I've yet to see anyone read it myself. You know, I'm really looking forward to the moment when I see someone read it. I'd probably just run over and kiss them or hug them. The police will probably be called. They'll probably, you know.
Is there a picture of you in the book?
No.
There's not. Oh, you missed a trick. Because they could recognize you and, you know, you could have had that.
Yeah, or, I'm a bit gutted.
Do you have a pen with you? You could just bring a pen around with you, and every time you see the book, someone reading the book, just go, do you want to sign?
Oh, yeah, no, I could definitely do that if I ever catch someone. So, I mean, you know, anyone, like, please, even pretend you're reading it. Just bring your book out, you know, just, you know, I'm thinking of paying somebody, you know, like, to kind of, you know, do it for me, you know, just sort of.
But this is the challenge for listeners. If you're in Brighton and you've got the Good Son book, and you see a bearded man running towards you. It's Paul.
It's Paul. Yeah. Open your arms. Get yourself ready. Pucker up. There might be kissing. You know, I'm definitely up for all of that.
Cool. So, what's ahead after this book? So the book is done and dusted. Sure. What's next?
It's interesting because you know, the book. It's amazing how much work goes into it. You know, even after it's out. You know, so I mean, it's amazing stuff. I mean, I was in Turkey there for a week with the British Council. And I go for a book tour, I think maybe in September around Germany. I'm looking at, I'm writing some short stories at the minute. I've one, you know, I've just submitted that's going to be in the London magazine. And I'm, there's been talk of me writing a script.
Okay.
Of the novel to sort of translate it into a screenplay stroke sort of theatre script. Which I'm thinking about.
Okay. You're not quite done with Mickey Donnelly yet, I guess.
Not at the moment, you know. But I do have another idea that's floating. I'm one of these weirdos. I write in my head a lot.
Mm.
So I spend years like putting things together, and then like you know, I can then sit down and like sometimes a short story, I could be writing it in my head for 3 or 4 years, and I sit down, I write it in an afternoon. And people say, oh, how long does it take you write a short story? Well, actually, it took, you know, 3 or 4 years. But, you know, it looks like it only took an afternoon. But I've been working on it. And this book, I'm writing it in my head. I'm coming up with plot lines and stories and arcs. And I mean, I think that, you know, people, some authors write like that and plan really a lot. And others just start writing and hope for the best. I tried that once and I wasted so much time because I wrote myself into a corner that I found it quite difficult to do. I didn't enjoy it. So I've now found what works for me, but it takes a long time.
Yeah, but you have it. You have your creative process now.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll see what happens. Yeah, and also, you know, we'll see. I'm reluctant to talk about it too much because I think that sometimes, you know, talking about an idea is like writing it. And once you've talked about it a lot, when you sit down to write it, you actually feel like you've done it and the passion's gone, the desire.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
You sort of need that little bit of kind of secretiveness sort of to make you go, oh, here it is, I'm writing it down, capturing it now, you know.
Good. Right, okay. So I'm going to wrap it up here now. Well, the best of luck with whatever you do next. And again, I would recommend your book highly to everyone, really, that's listening at the moment.
So would I.
That's good.
I would really recommend my book. I think it's great.
And there's a free autograph in it as well. If you're reading it around Brighton, there's a free autograph in it.
Please let me autograph it. Please. I'll give you £1 and let me sign it.
I don't think you can get a fairer offer than that. That's a great offer. Now, if you do want to find out more about the events for the City Reads Festival, collectedworks.co.uk is the web address to go to, and you will find out all the events there. You can book tickets as well to the events that haven't sold out yet. a few of them already sold out. Paul, thanks a million for coming in today.
Thank you.
An absolute joy talking to you. And the best luck with everything.
All right. Thank you.